Quadriga could have been the story of Canada's biggest cryptocurrency success. Instead, it's a story of duped investors, missing money, a possible death, and many, many investigations.
Canada's largest cryptocurrency exchange is in hot water, and thousands of clients have millions of dollars in frozen assets with little information.
Quadriga was a Bitcoin exchange. But this story is not about Bitcoin. It's a story about the Canadian man who built that Bitcoin empire. A story about the $250 million that vanished when the empire collapsed. And a story about, well, about whether or not the only person on Earth that had access to that $250 million is alive or dead. And we may never know. But some people have their suspicions. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Nathaniel Rich wrote today's story for Vanity Fair. He's also a writer at large at New York Times Magazine. He's the author of novels as well as a recent book called Losing Earth, A Recent History. Hey, Nathaniel.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing really well, and I'm fascinated by the story of Gerald Cotton and Quadriga. How did you even begin to dive into this?
Well, I had the mistaken idea that I would report this article like any other piece I might report. And so I traveled to Halifax and Toronto for about a week over the summer to try to speak with as many people as possible who might, you have known Jerry Cotton or been in his orbit, and also the lawyers now involved with the case. And as I quickly gathered, after my first conversation with these lawyers at Miller Thompson, this fancy Bay Street firm that represents the class of creditors who lost all their money to Quadriga, all of the action was actually going on online. And I learned that even the real investigations that were underway by the RCMP, the FBI, we now know there are a couple other federal law enforcement agencies from other countries investigating this case, as well as the Ernst & Young, the accounting firm that was trying to claw back money for the creditor class, that all of these investigations were actually taking their cues from these anonymous postings on social media, and which I assumed were not to be trusted, but as it turned out, everything about this case is sort of upside down, and a lot of the most serious investigators were in fact these anonymous online people who were just investigating from their homes online.
Well, why don't we start with an explanation of who Jerry Cotton was or is? Describe him and what he did.
Yeah, he was a young guy from Belleville who the official narrative was that, he went to York College and got a degree an undergraduate degree in business, became enthusiastic about cryptocurrency, and decided to start a Canadian cryptocurrency exchange to allow people to buy and sell and trade Bitcoin and later other cryptocurrencies. And he came about it at what was in retrospect exactly the right time. There were a couple of exchanges available to Canadians then, but they didn't work very well and they quickly went out of business. And the exchange that he began, which had a very sort of simple interface and promised lots of security protections, almost overnight in 2015, 2016, became the dominant cryptocurrency exchange, the marketplace to buy and sell cryptocurrency in Canada.
How rich did that make him eventually?
Well, his personal wealth is a tricky subject. The company lost money, we know now, in its first couple of years, but as Bitcoin went on this stratospheric rise, he you know, Quadriga took a cut of every trade on the platform. And it seems now that at least the business was taking in tens of millions of dollars a year, ultimately, you know, processing more than $1 billion in volume over the course of a year, and had by the end of last year, 2018, had about $250 million just on the platform. Now, Cotton, we know, had assets of at least $12 million Canadian. Probably the number is quite a bit higher than that. But where it gets a little bit difficult is in the fact that he basically began stealing money right off of the platform, and so it's hard to tell where his money stopped and the Quadriga's funds began, as it were.
Can you tell me how he died, and more importantly, how this story kind of exploded when that happened?
Yeah, so Quadriga started having some problems in 2018, at least publicly. The public became aware that it was having some problems. People were having trouble getting their money out when they'd request withdrawals. There were a couple of high-profile lawsuit where CIBC seized something like $25 million of funds that belong to Quadriga because it grew suspicious about some of its banking practices. There was also the loss of about $14 million worth of Ether thanks to a software glitch that basically just locked up that money and made it inaccessible, which Quadriga, you know, acknowledged at the time. And so the complaint started growing. People couldn't get their money out of the exchange. And at the height of this anxiety or concern, Jerry Cotton went on his honeymoon to Jaipur, India, with his new wife, Jennifer Robertson. And as the story goes, he died. He died of complications from Crohn's disease, which he had. Presumably, he ate something that disagreed with him. And, you know, it's not a condition that's usually fatal among, you know, 30-year-olds. Mm-hmm. He had just turned 30. But he was in India. Who knows what he ate? And also, more importantly, who knows what kind of medical treatment he got? But in any case, he got a stomach ache one night on his honeymoon, and within 24 hours, he was dead.
You said, as the story goes.
Yeah, so fairly quickly, there was this question of was he really dead, and whether he faked his own death, because what first came out from this was that Cotton was the only person who had the passwords to all the accounts where the funds from Quadriga were stored. So it was basically $250 million was missing, and the other people who had access, I can't say really other employees because there were no other official employees, but the contractors and his widow who had access to the infrastructure of Quadriga could not access the money. They didn't have the passwords. And so there was an immediate suspicion that people in the cryptocurrency sphere, which is a very suspicious community to begin with, that Cotton perhaps faked his own death and had absconded with all of the money. That was the beginning of the mystery, but there were many other levels to it that were revealed over the coming months.
Well, maybe explain how something like that happens. And if you have to explain a little bit about a Bitcoin exchange, please do. But how can he die and nobody else have access to any of these funds?
Right. It's almost inconceivable to people in that world, because I suppose I have to do a little cryptocurrency 101, which is to say that, you know, every Bitcoin is kept by its owners in these files, basically called wallets. And the way Bitcoin is set up is that in order to access your wallet, you have your own password, essentially a key. And it's extremely, and it's randomly generated and complicated. And most people, you know, keep it on a piece of paper because once you lose it, once you lose access to it, you can't get it back. This is not some secret. This is sort of Bitcoin 101. As soon as you have Bitcoin, you need to understand that there's this privacy element to it, security element that has to be, you have to take great care with. Cotton himself had spoken about this in interviews before and had even said that he kept his passwords on a piece of paper in a locked box, which is a common practice. So it was very mystifying to people that this would have happened. He'd spoken publicly about how the way he kept Quadrigo's accounts locked, and he also had told friends and family that if anything happened to him, that there was a process, presumably an email or something like that would go out to his friends and family after a certain amount of time of inactivity, and they would receive those passwords electronically in some fashion.
But they didn't.
And so this didn't really make any sense to folks. And ultimately, what observers were able to figure out, basically professionals who were able to do some sleuthing into tracking the movement of funds between Quadriga's wallets and other publicly available wallets that could be observed through the blockchain, which is a whole, I could also explain just very, parenthetically, is essentially a public ledger of every transaction that takes place with cryptocurrency. So using online tools, basically, people were able to determine that at least some of the wallets, if not all of the wallets that had been used by Quadriga to store these funds, were not actually full, that they had already been emptied. And so that these mysterious wallets that nobody could get access to, in all likelihood, had very few funds to begin with, which only deepened the mystery, because the question was, if the $250 million was not in these wallets, where had it gone?
So it appears that Jerry is dead and the money, if there is money, is inaccessible, but it also appears that a lot of that money is missing. Tell me about all the investigations. You briefly mentioned them off the top that kind of started when this became known.
Yeah, so Bitcoin in Canada in particular exists or did exist then, a year ago, 2 years ago, in this very nebulous, unregulated space. Banks refused to do business with most Bitcoin businesses. So Quadriga was already operating in the kind of margins of legal society. They weren't doing things that were necessarily illegal, but they were in a kind of Wild West atmosphere. They were using loopholes to move money around. They weren't the only ones to do it, but as a result, when all this money went missing, there weren't very clear legal procedures in place to go after the money. And so the process that began was actually a bankruptcy process for Quadriga. When Quadriga couldn't pay back the people who had money on the exchange, a court appointed a monitor, essentially a third party or organization, to try to claw back as much money as they could. And that was Ernst & Young, this Big Four accounting firm. And they were given access to Quadriga's passwords, and to the extent that they existed, and internal files and so on. And so Ernst & Young started their own investigation and basically were able to find about $20 or $30 million, a third of which were in assets belonging to Cotton's widow, mainly real estate, and the rest, so some loose change that was left in accounts that were accessible, and then the rest of it was mostly money that was being handled by payment processors, who are these sort of separate business entities, very shady, who were essentially the go-between between Quadriga and traditional banks. So some of the money was locked away with these other companies, and some of those companies agreed to return the funds. So that added up to about $30 million. Meanwhile, The RCMP began its own investigation, which I'm told from sources was very casual and unsophisticated and essentially ineffectual. The FBI, however, began a more robust investigation, and those investigations are ongoing, and we don't have much insight into where they stand now, except from what, you know, we've been told by people who have been interviewed by them. And again, the sense is that the RCMP is not conducting a very serious investigation from all that I've heard, but that the FBI is, and it may be that they've made some breakthroughs that we don't know about. But up to this point, the basic picture is that in terms of the funds is that, you know, we just have those 30 million or so dollars, and the rest is either completely gone or missing or, you know, impossible to claw back from various entities around the world that might have it, other trading platforms that the money was moved on to by Cotton during the last year or so.
Well, you also mentioned, and I found it fascinating in your piece, this like shadow investigation that is taking place on the internet, on cryptocurrency forums and Reddit and stuff. Tell me about that and how you found it and what they found.
Yeah, so the major breakthrough, and yes, this was, you know, this was something that was figured out not by the RCMP or the FBI or Ernst & Young, but by these online sleuths, some of whom were creditors. So, you know, people lost money on Quadriga, very sophisticated, you know, financial Bitcoin people who were pissed that, you know, that they'd been taken advantage of.
And who actually know that world.
Who actually know the world and in fact know it a lot better than these federal law enforcement agencies, who were very confused by the basics of you know, cryptocurrency, it seems. So the major discovery that they had fairly early on was that Jerry Cotton was not who he seemed. He was not is not truly a Bitcoin enthusiast. What he was a serial scam artist. And they figured that out by going into the dark web and into archived web pages that are no longer up online from these basically these weird clearinghouse Ponzi scheme websites that exist or have existed, in which, you know, they're sort of marketplaces for cons, in which people go on to sell pyramid schemes to suckers. But it's also places where, you know, people who conduct pyramid schemes, you know, talk with themselves about strategies and marketing efforts. And one of these sites, there is this really kind of sort of dusty, cramped, kind of sordid corner of the internet. But one of these, the most prominent of these, was a site called Talk Gold. And Jerry Cotton, from the age of 14, was a frequent poster on this website. And if you go back, as they did very meticulously, because you can't use search engines to access these sites, you have to kind of scroll through years of chat room posts. What they put together, these you know, online folks, was that Cotton was engaged in ripping people off from the age of 14 in a series of Ponzi schemes that basically followed the same pattern. He would offer, you know, absurd returns on investment. The underlying investment strategy was usually fairly obscure. He said, just, you know, trust me, I'll be able to, you know, if you give me $10, I'll return, you know, 200, things like that. And, you know, the kinds of things you can't imagine working on anybody, but basically, you know, if you just get a few people, I suppose, you know, it's a way to hustle some money. And he did a series of these over many years, all the way up until he founded Quadriga. And there's a very clear pathway towards Quadriga. The scheme's getting more and more sophisticated, relying more heavily on cryptocurrency, and working his way up to Quadriga. And in every case, you know, leading up to Quadriga, his previous schemes would end in exactly the same way that Quadriga ended, which is a bunch of creditors asking for their money back and Cotton making a bunch of excuses about how, why he could not, you know, return money. And essentially, you know, the investors getting weary at a certain point and giving up the chase and moving onto the next investment. And so Quadriga fit the pattern, albeit on a far grander scale, of this kind of sordid pyramid scheme process that Cotton had been conducting since he was an adolescent.
When they kind of discovered all the links that lead up to Quadriga, did they find anything that linked out to anyone else that would give them sort of anything to move on and keep digging?
Yeah, the big revelation was that early on, that even led to this backstory of Gerald Cotton, was that it was a closer look at the co-founder of Quadriga. His name is Michael Patron, and it became pretty quickly clear that Patron had a criminal past. He was a federal convict in the U.S., was deported to Canada for his role in a sort of a money laundering, identity theft operation. Had a series, was also involved in Talk Gold from a very early age, and in fact had met Cotton online in Talk Gold, it seems. And so there was sort of an open secret within the Canadian cryptocurrency world that Patron was an operator, was not, you know, not on the up and up, had some underworld connections. And so, you know, even though he was a less visible member, you know, he wasn't out there talking about Quadriga nearly as much as Cotton. Cotton was really the public face of the enterprise. After Cotton's death, people looked a little more closely into Patron's past and started to realize that, you know, Patron and Cotton were working as a team and had been doing so since, you know, just about, you know, the year they met when Cotton was 14.
What happened when they started digging into Patron? Where did that discovery lead them?
Well, I mean, it led them into Talk Gold. It led them into this series of money laundering schemes. It led to a criminal record. It led to accounts from people who had been close to Patron who didn't trust him, who were kind of spooked by him. And to this day, you know, a lot of my sources were afraid to speak on the record or give, you know, attribution to their quotes because they're afraid of Patron. And there was a high level of risk tolerance in the cryptocurrency world, particularly, you know, a few years ago. There were a lot of shady folks involved in this industry, and it's a real sore spot for people who are trying to, you know, make the business legitimate and to have it rise out of this, you know, the controversy and assumptions of, you know, vague criminality associated with cryptocurrency. And so early on, you know, it was not uncommon for people to kind of look the other way if people running these businesses might have had a questionable past. There was hope that they would go legitimate. And it seemed to some, even, you know, those who knew about Patron early on, that Quadriga represented a sincere effort by, if not Patron, then at least Cotton, to run a legitimate business, one that seemed to be profitable. But certainly when things went sideways, there's a lot more suspicion about whether, you know, it was really on the up and up in the first place. And, you know, I think anyone coming to it objectively can't look at a business that started by these two sort of serial scammers and trust that it's a legitimate business all of a sudden after more than a decade of them partnering on confidence game after confidence game.
So once all that stuff's discovered and Patron's role is discovered and people are concerned about him, where does that leave the actual Quadriga case?
Well, I mean, what is happening is that the creditors are furious and they've put in their claims, and this claim process is a very long, drawn out process where, you know, anybody who lost money on the exchange has to put in their own claim, and then the money that's seized, which again is just, you know, a little more than a tenth of what's been missing is then apportioned out to the creditors. You know, I think some of the creditors, there's 76,000 individual accounts that are users that had money on the platform. I don't think 76,000 people will come forward to claim the money. I think some of those accounts, perhaps, you know, a majority of those accounts were held by people who don't want to make their identities known to law enforcement for all kinds of reasons. But certainly some of those people will get some of their money back. The Ernst & Young, which is the accounting firm that's trying to that's supervising that process, you know, their responsibility is to their investors to get as much money back as possible. Their responsibility is not to solve the crime and not to determine whether Cotton is dead. And it's not even to go back to go after some of the more speculative leads in order to find the money, because it's expensive to do that kind of investigation. Their goal is simply to maximize the amount of money they can get back to their creditors. So it's a very limited investigation. As I lay out in the piece, there's sort of three narratives that I think are one can imagine having taken place. One is that Cotton, you know, legitimately tried to, you know, despite maybe starting the Quadriga as one of his schemes, once he saw the market was there, once the price of Bitcoin soared from, you know, a couple hundred dollars to $20,000 nearly over the course of a year or two, that he might have decided to take the business public and do the right thing, and then only managed to squander some of the money through a lot of, you know, some mistakes and also some problems that weren't of his own creation, like the Ether software glitch, for instance, or some of these third-party payment processors that Quadriga had to use to get around banking restrictions. Some of those companies just stole money from Quadriga, and in an effort to try to make that money back for his clients and for the platform, he moved the money off the platform and into some personal accounts on other exchanges and took some huge bets in a desperate effort to try to win the money back, essentially. So that's kind of the most charitable explanation, is that Cotton is, you know, trying to do well, but not being smart about it. I think the more likely scenario is that, you know, this is a scheme from the beginning, but in his incompetence and recklessness, Cotton, you know, dug himself into a hole, you know, had money stolen from him, you know, tried to, you know, the evidence we have is that the money he moved off the exchange, which seems to be perhaps most of the money, he then used to make these very high-risk bets on other forms of, you know, more obscure forms of cryptocurrency that most people haven't even heard of, that fluctuate, you know, the prices fluctuate wildly, and he took huge bets on those, it seems. So, you know, essentially he dug a hole for himself and then kept digging it deeper and deeper until he squandered $200-something million, and then had the bad luck to die on his honeymoon. But of course, there's the third option, which is the kind of the mastermind theory, I call it, in which Cotton, in fact, planned it this way all along. The money he moved off the account was not actually lost in wild Hail Mary bets, but in fact was essentially laundered through these very unusual trades into other accounts that he controlled. And under this theory, he would have moved all that money through a series of, you know, trades on these other exchanges into his own personal coffers and then faked his own death. And is sitting somewhere on an island, perhaps with a new face and all his money, and perhaps is waiting for his widow to join him, or his, you know,
alleged widow,
non-widow in that scenario, his wife, I guess. Or perhaps, you know, tricked her as well. You know, none of the theories totally makes sense, which is why it's such a fascinating story. And what I tried to do in writing it was lay out, you know, the most plausible case for each of these theories, while also indicating the holes in each of them. So there is no fully satisfying answer. And I think if you ask most people who've looked, you know, who've been obsessively following the case, they'd say, you know, 70% chance he's dead, 30% chance he's alive, something like that. Even the lawyers in the case will say that. The FBI and the RCMP seem to not be clear about whether he's alive. And ultimately, the only way to determine for certain would be to dig up the body and make sure that it's really his. And so far, RCMP has shown no interest in doing so.
Do you think we'll ever know what really happened here?
I think we'll know more. I think at some point you hope that the FBI will make public anything that it finds, but it might not have found anything that we don't
right.
know, you know, that these investigators haven't already unearthed. It's possible some of these other exchanges that Cotton put the money on maybe are participating with the FBI, so there might be more information available to them to track the flow of funds. But it's hard to, you know, you would think we would learn more, but we may not ever. There's no guarantee that we'll know anything beyond what we already do.
If I had to put a gun to your head, is he alive?
Gun to my head, I'd say he's dead, but I wouldn't bet my mortgage on it either.
Thanks so much, Nathaniel.
Thanks for having me.
Nathaniel Rich wrote the Quadriga piece for Vanity Fair. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also find us at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can find all of our shows there, in fact. And you can find all of our shows on social media at Frequency Pods on Twitter, on Facebook, or on Instagram. You know the drill by now if you like this show. The best thing you can do is tell your friends, leave a rating, and write a review because people read those things. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.